He's involved in a number of businesses.
He's a great role model.
Telling it like it is, giving you both sides of the story. This is Katz at Night.
Great American, a great New Yorker.
Now, here's John Katzimatidis. Breaking news, WABC.
And we're just moments away from General Petraeus. He will have the latest breaking news out of Ukraine. And first, we have other guests we want to introduce here in the studio.
In the studio with us is Judge Richard Weinberg. We have a Common Sense Democrat, Common Sense Republicans, Tony Carbonetti, former Chief of Staff of Rudy Giuliani, and Craig Eaton, Chairman for 10 years of the Brooklyn GOP. I understand General Petraeus is on the line.
Correct. General Petraeus, how are you, sir?
Good, thanks. How are you?
Good. I mean, General, nobody seems to know what's really going on. We figured who else to go to but to you. And you must have some calls coming in from all over the place. Give the American people an update of what you think is going on.
Well, if you're talking about Ukraine, what's going on is the Russians tried the blitz to try to get immediately to cities to topple them, particularly Kyiv, the capital, so that they could replace President Zelensky with someone who would be pro-Russian. That obviously didn't work. They showed that they were not as impressive as perhaps we thought they might be at air-ground integration, combined arms, infantry, armor, field artillery, engineers, and so forth. And also we found that the Ukrainian armed forces had enormous determination, sheer grit, considerable skill. And, of course, they're backed up by a population, virtually all of whom hate the Russians and many of whom are willing to take up arms against them. They're also fighting on their home field, if you will. They know the local areas, they know the people, and they're fighting for their homeland. So Putin did not achieve quickly what perhaps he and his generals thought they might achieve. They got bogged down. They've also shown to have not particularly impressive logistics support, plus, of course, all of their logistics lines, the lines of communication behind them, are insecure because the people oppose what the Russians want to do. So they're in a tough spot. And then what they did is bring in additional firepower, also use some from in Russia that can reach all the way into Ukraine. They have traditionally been an indirect fire-based army, a lot of artillery, a lot of rockets, missiles, and bombs. And what we see them doing now is beginning essentially to blast away. Putin, in the past, when Grozny was difficult to take in Chechnya, they essentially, eventually, did both. They depopulated and they largely destroyed it. The same in Aleppo, when Russian air power was used there to prop up Bashar al-Assad in Syria. And again, essentially depopulated and largely destroyed it. And we see that beginning. We see Kharkiv, for example, one of the largest cities, been in the square where the beautiful government building was destroyed, along with 8 or 10 civilians in it. We see them starting to go after infrastructure in Kyiv. And keep in mind, Kyiv's a city of nearly 3 million people. It's very spread out, a lot of urban area. Urban fighting is exceedingly difficult, especially, again, if everybody who's left there really wants to do you in. So they've got a tough road ahead of them. But again, I think they're frustrated and they're going to exhibit that frustration again by just pummeling these areas. They're literally going to try to turn out the lights in Kyiv. They're going to try to turn off the telecommunications, get President Zelensky off the air, shut down the internet, social media, and do in the other infrastructure that is still functioning. At some point, they may literally lay siege to Kyiv after trying to scare as many of the civilians out of the city as they can, and then starve the rest. And again, this is getting very, very ugly.
I mean, it's crazy what's going on. Any chance that Putin could say, guys, let's call it a day?
Well, it's difficult to see that. Again, he has stated clearly what his aims are, and they are to ensure that Ukraine is never in NATO, never in the EU. And frankly, he also feared all along that there would be an example in his next-door neighbor of what right looks like, of a vibrant, prosperous democracy. And that is a huge challenge to him as well. So he wants to dominate Ukraine. He sees it as part of Russia historically. We heard this in that somewhat bizarre speech that he gave, very lengthy, sitting on one side of an enormous area and all of his people on the other side. And he is determined, I think, to carry on. Now, yes, we should be seeking an off-ramp somehow. We should be seeking a messenger who could take a message to him. I've suggested that perhaps Chancellor Merkel of Germany, the former chancellor, who had a good relationship with him, albeit a firm one, who grew up in East Germany, a place where he served, of course, in the KGB, speaks Russian and so forth. That could be the right person. The problem is the message, because the respective red lines of the Russians on the one hand and then Ukraine and also NATO countries on the other hand, these are mutually exclusive.
Well, General, it's so Tony Carbonetti. That message, isn't it as simple as Iraq and Kuwait in 1990? You don't have the right to invade a neighboring country. And shouldn't the world get together at that point and say, get out, or we're going to come make you get out?
And General Petraeus, it appears that even the Russians aren't backing Putin, because some of the Russian soldiers who invaded Ukraine are so unhappy with their mission that they've started sabotaging their own vehicles and are surrendering in droves. This according to the Pentagon. And apparently a lot of the soldiers weren't even fully trained or prepared or aware that they were going to be sent into a combat operation. This is according to a senior Defense Department official telling reporters this. So,
well, there are some instances of that. I wouldn't expect to see the entire force resort to that. There is history here, you know, and let's not forget the way the communists came to power in 1917 was obviously the overthrow of the Romanovs, essentially, when the army just really refused to continue to support that regime. So there is some history here. You can look at 1905 with the Russo-Japanese War as another example of that. But, Tony, I mean, what you've said, it seems appealing until you realize that, unlike Saddam Hussein, Russia has nuclear weapons, and they reach to the United States. It's actually the largest nuclear arsenal in the world. We certainly have one very, very comparable and perhaps even more modern and better in some respects. But with nuclear weapons, as you know, it doesn't take many.
They don't really want to die. But again, to go nuclear, his army is sitting there saying, we're not going to get nuked unless we strike first. We're not going to attack. We're not going to use nuclear weapons against them unless they use them first. Correct?
Well, again, it's not his army that gets to choose whether they use nuclear weapons, Tony. It's Putin himself. He has the finger on the nuclear trigger. He rattled the saber, the nuclear saber, the other day, made allusions to it. Generally, I tend to agree that it is insanity to reach for that trigger because, of course, you're going to receive back at least as much as you gave. That said, there are scenarios where someone in his state of mind, which doesn't seem to be completely
I agree
where everyone else is, and so you're not going to risk. And so are you saying that you should put U.S. troops into and NATO troops to force them out? You want to see a direct confrontation with Russia?
I don't think the American people are the only option.
I think we have to.
That's the only option you
have. We've got to push back.
Fine. How? We have pushed back. We have levied the most extraordinary sanctions, literally, that the world has ever seen. They are very painful. The ruble's down. They can't even open up their stock exchange. Their financial system is already feeling the pain. They'll feel a lot more of that over time. I think there's some other things they might ought to do, like padlocking the doors in Kensington and Mayfair and London, of the townhouses of the oligarchs.
I'm for all of that, and cyber attack the hell out of that.
Well, now, you know, again, these are all appealing things when you sort of throw them out. But in the real world, if you cyber attack the hell out of them, they will cyber attack the hell out of us. And we are actually probably more vulnerable. You know, that old saying about don't throw glass or stones if you live in a glass house. And we live in a glass house when it comes to cyberspace. So, again, these are
General.
It sounds great to say we got to do something. We are doing something. We have provided substantial amounts of weapons, various military hardware systems, supplies, et cetera. More is being provided, surprisingly, including even Germany, which is very impressive because, of course, initially they hesitated. They gave them Kevlar helmets. Now they're providing lethal supplies. Germany's also going to go to 2% of GDP on spending immediately rather than the very slow glide path that seemed glacial in its progress. They're spending an extra $110 million on defense as a one-time supplemental. I mean, this is massive from Germany. And, of course, they shut down Nord Stream 2. So there's a lot being done, a huge amount being done.
What would you recommend?
What you're suggesting is the kind of stuff that actually gets you into World War III or
don't want to go there.
Into a direct conflict with Russia.
Nobody wants to go into World War III.
No one wants to go there.
General, if you were sitting in the Oval Office advising the president, what would you say to him today?
To be fair in this case, and you will remember that I was very critical. Please, for your other guest there, I am totally nonpartisan, nonpolitical.
I
was very critical of the decision to withdraw from Afghanistan, the lack of adequate consultation with our allies on that decision, and then the execution of that decision. In this case, I actually think that they have done quite an impressive job. There's some places along the way that we might have done better. Have the entire list of sanctions ready so that when certain trigger is crossed or reached that you go to those. The problem with that was that many of these sanctions aren't just the province of the U.S. They require the U.S. to persuade our, let's say, EU allies when it comes to the SWIFT financial transaction system, which is a huge blow as well that we have taken to cut off some of the Russian financial institutions from that. So there's an enormous amount that has been done. They've also done a very good job, I think, of taking what clearly is finished intelligence products and laundering it into public information without exposing sources and methods. They have galvanized the NATO, the EU. Of course, really, it's Putin's actions that have done that. I was at the Munich Security Conference. I'd not heard unity like that. This is a week and a half ago. I'd not heard unity at a Munich Security Conference like we heard that time, all the way back to when I was speechwriter for the Supreme Allied Commander of Europe. So there's an enormous amount being done. There is also, however, a degree of what I think is proper and prudent caution about not getting into a direct confrontation with Russian forces, such as a no-fly zone over Ukraine, or even something that seems somewhat innocuous to secure a humanitarian corridor well into Ukraine or something like that.
We don't want to. I understand rightly, that. We don't want to put them in a position where we're backing him up into the corner.
I have a question for General Petraeus.
So, again, they're actually doing, I think, to be fair, quite well. Now, there's more that can be done in terms of, you know, we should have a defense supplemental ourselves. We're also going to have to overhaul our defense spending because we're now going to have to plan on, in a sense, for a two-front possibility rather than just focus completely on the Indo-Pacific. And as I said earlier, I think the big intellectual challenge right now is to figure out what message someone like Chancellor Merkel, if you could persuade her to take this on, could take to Vladimir Putin to try to convince him that it's time to declare a ceasefire, start negotiating, and ideally withdraw his forces. Again, this is not going to have a happy ending for Russian forces or Putin, probably, no matter how it plays out. And the more damage and destruction that he does to Ukrainian cities, obviously, the more he's going to be isolated. But there are just limits to how far the actions can be taken for fear of, again, getting into a direct confrontation. And again, we are making very clear On the other hand, you touch a NATO country, you have invoked, we invoke Article 5, an attack on one is an attack on all. And that means the three Baltic states, two of which have borders with Russia, and then the other now increasingly frontline Eastern European countries, Poland, Slovakia, Hungary, and Romania.
It doesn't look like China is going to back up Putin.
It does not. They are somewhat ambivalent, if you will, John. They, of course, had the very famous meeting on the eve of the Olympic opening ceremony, Putin and President Xi. Subsequent to that, however, the foreign minister of China at the Munich Security Conference virtually said that territorial integrity of all states should be honored, and that included Ukraine. And, of course, keep in mind that Ukraine's biggest trading partner was China, and China had a lot of potential projects there for the Belt and Road Initiative. Beyond that, China generally is one of those countries that says, stay out of the internal affairs of others. This clearly is a violation of that. And again, if the damage and the destruction is truly horrific, as it is appearing it's going to be, then clearly China cannot abide that at a certain point in time. They did not veto the UN Security Council resolution the other day condemning Russia. The U.S. modified some of the language so that they would not do that. They abstained. But again, at a point, if this is as horrific as it appears it may be, there's really no country, maybe other than North Korea, that could say that this is acceptable.
Well, I think, General, thank you for coming on. I think Putin is backing himself up into a position where he is hurting Russia itself in many, many ways. He's hurting all his friends, all the oligarchs.
No question.
And this might be a problem that Russia itself might have to solve.
General Petraeus, I know we have to go to a quick break. I just
one other, John, if I could, sorry. Because there is a concern that he and we back him into a corner from which he has nothing to lose.
Right.
That is not necessarily a great place to have someone who is in his state of mind and has his finger
we
on
don't
the
need him.
Trigger. So we have to be careful of that.
That's the
question
I want to ask.
We don't need him to push a button.
Are you afraid,
right.
General Petraeus, President Biden was asked yesterday, should the U.S. be worried about a nuclear war? General Petraeus, are you worried that he could press that button and forever change the world?
Look, I think you have to recognize that as a possibility, which we do always. That is always a state of play in the nuclear business and the strategic command. That's what they get paid to do, is to be prepared. But perhaps that should have a bit more urgency attached to it right now than normally.
I agree 100%. I think we made him look the world is making him look dumb, and he might have that might be the only.
Yeah, his only recourse, dude.
General, it's a day-by-day situation. Thank you so much for keeping the American people.
Always a pleasure, John. Thank you so
much. Thank you. Let's go directly to
Professor Dershowitz. Professor Dershowitz, I'm sorry to keep you on hold. We had some breaking news with General Petraeus.
No problem. General Petraeus is one of the smartest men in America. Please listen to him very carefully.
And we're all worried that we're going to back up Putin in the corner, and he'll do something even, how did I used to say it?
Stupider.
Yeah. I don't think that's going to happen.
I hope not.
But we have to be prepared for that. I think the president has a special obligation tonight to be nonpartisan. He has to make a speech today that speaks to the world, that speaks to Putin, NATO, that brings Americans together. He cannot use this state of the union message to promote his party, his candidacy, or his accomplishments over the last year. That would be a terrible waste. This is a Churchillian, Rooseveltian moment, and he has to do it. He has to be, and the Republicans have to cheer him and praise him, but he's the one who has to make the first step forward. He has to do nothing partisan, nothing that invites any Republican not to cheer. He has to bring us together. If he wants to talk about COVID, that's fine, but talk about COVID in a way that brings us together. But tonight is a night for uniting the world and keeping the world united. I hope he's up to that.
Well, I think we all pray for that. Does anybody have any ideas here in the office? I think he's going to try to avoid talking about certain things.
I think he's going to try and take some credit for what's going on in the world.
Well, it's kind of to what John has been saying, the whole wag the dog thing. Yeah, he might use it as a kind of diversionary tactic to what the real problems that are facing America right now, which, I mean, I'm not saying Russia does it, Russia and Ukraine. But
they're going to find some small tidbits of some good news, and they're going to try and blow that out as he's doing such a great job as the world is crumbling.
Well, he's going to declare the pandemic's over.
Yeah. Well, the Ukraine is really the most important thing right now.
I agree with Professor Dershowitz. Alan, it's Richard Weinberg. I want to talk to you about the Supreme Court case that was argued, I believe, yesterday. It's a West Virginia case on the EPA regulations.
Right.
What do you think about that? And would you please explain to the audience?
EPA. Yeah, it's not about EPA and it's not about climate control. It's about a big agenda item that conservative judges have been going after now for a decade, and that is, do administrative agencies have the power that the administrative agencies like to claim they have, or does the power belong to Congress? I mean, there was no doubt in anybody's mind among the nine justices that Congress has the power to do what the agencies did. The question is, have they delegated that power to these agencies, or have the agencies taken them to itself? So it's really about democracy. And even though I'm a liberal, I'm generally in favor of making Congress decide, not having bureaucrats, anonymous bureaucrats, make big, big policy decisions that weigh the environment against employment. These are big questions, and they should be done openly by Congress, who have to run every 2 years, not by administrators who can hide behind anonymity.
And it's particularly important now because a great lesson we've learned is we need to be energy independent again, and the administration has to stop this war against American energy independence. And so the real stakes on this decision.
Yeah, and these are decisions that Congress ought to make and elected officials ought to make. And, you know, the more you move away from elected officials who appointed bureaucrats, the more you move away from democracy. And so this is all about democracy. And I hope the court doesn't politicize the issue and comes to the right decision. Justice Breyer, who I've known for, almost 60 years, that was his specialty. And he believes in administrative agencies. He taught administrative law. So he'll be on the administrative agency side of this. And probably Justice Kagan will, too, although her views are a little uncertain. We know where the conservative judges will stand, and I suspect the EPA will lose this one.
Well, thank you so much, Professor Alan Dershowitz. We got so many. We have so many great guests coming up. We have also we are going to have Scott Pruitt. We're going to have Representative Scott Pruitt and a lot more news. Charlie Gasparino on the markets and John Solomon with some latest breaking news. So we'll be right back.
A common sense recap of the day's biggest stories. It's John Katzimatidis and Cats at Night on 77 WABC.
And on the line with us right now, we have John Solomon, intrepid investigative reporter, justthenews.com. And you also have a great TV show you can watch there as well. John Solomon, what is the latest, hottest breaking news?
Well, there's a lot of it. Everybody will be watching President Joe Biden tonight as he gives his first State of the Union address to Congress. There's some Republicans who won't be watching. They're refusing to go because of the mandatory COVID testing rules. But most of the nation will be watching and listening to what he has to say about the pandemic, the Russia crisis, rising inflation, rising crime, to see if they get the answers they're looking for. On the eve of that, or just a few hours before that, we broke a pretty fun story here. We got a hold of a memo that Joe Biden sent to federal workforce leaders saying it's time for everybody to come back to the office. So that is some big news going around Washington. Federal workers have pretty much been on permanent telecommuting for the last 2 years, but Joe Biden sent this note this morning ahead of his speech to tell them that we're returning to normalcy and it's time for you to return to your offices. So that's getting a lot of attention. Then I'll take you to Wisconsin, where the former Chief Justice of the Wisconsin Supreme Court, Mike Gableman, was named 6-7 months ago to do an investigation of the Wisconsin 2020 election. And today he let go some bombshell revelations, including that there was some fraud in which nursing home residents had other people vote for them. They didn't know it. They didn't know they were voting. Of course, there's been some rulings out there that said there were some illegal election law changes that were made. But the headline that has gotten everybody's attention is the former Chief Justice of the Wisconsin Supreme Court says there is now enough evidence of irregularities in the Wisconsin 2020 election, almost 2 years ago now, to warrant the legislature considering decertifying Joe Biden's victory there. It would be a symbolic gesture. We're not getting rid of Joe Biden from the White House. But if a state said, you know, after the fact, we looked at this vote, it was so messy, we don't trust it, that would send shockwaves through the nation. So that
and John Solomon, someday we will find out who really killed John Kennedy.
That's right. Yes, exactly. It's a remarkable moment in testimony.
Yeah. We had another question. So John and I were talking about this convoy of Russian troops, right? They've been how long outside of Kiev? It's like miles and miles long. What is taking them so
long? Does anybody really know what's going on, John?
There's a lot of fog of war, as there always is in war, right? But I think the Russians miscalculated and they're recalibrating. They thought this was going to be a cakewalk, that the Ukrainians would throw up their arms and the comedian who turned president would turn out to be weak. And he turns out to be, you know, Churchill on TV. And the resistance they have found was so much tougher than they expected. And so they are, I believe, recalibrating. All the U.S. intelligence officials I'm talking to say they're rethinking the military strategy. There's two ways to go here, right? You can just blitzkrieg Ukraine, but I don't think Putin has the will within his own people to see that happen. Most Russians consider Ukrainians to be their brethren. So he's trying to do surgical strikes and surgical attacks, and the Ukrainians have been very good at almost like the Revolutionary War tag team that George Washington had early on, guerrilla warfare. And it has confounded the Russians. And so, there's a big column sitting outside Kiev, but Kiev still remains remarkably in Ukraine's control.
It seems like there's very, very little credible information coming out at all.
Yeah, and of course, this is a region that's known for misinformation. And while we always blame the Russians for doing it, the Ukrainians are pretty good at doing a propaganda campaign, too. So we're sorting fact from fiction. But the U.S. intelligence people I'm talking to, I've done maybe a dozen interviews today with U.S. Intel and other people, say that there's been very fierce fighting, a lot of bombardment, and yet the Ukrainians have control of their top two cities, and the Russians appear to be frustrated a little bit. But, you know, over time, Russia has a much larger force, and the question is, how long can Ukraine hold out, and how many more European countries will come to the rescue of Ukraine and start sending armaments and other supplies? But it is a head-scratcher, and we're all trying to figure it out. I think U.S. Intel believes there'll be a counteroffensive by the Russians in the next 24, 48 hours to see if their new strategy works.
I mean, we're seeing some of these videos of, like, regular civilians standing in front of tanks and surrounding them. Yeah. And you wonder, is it true? Is it in the satellite images?
It's the same video we've seen time after time. It's not different videos.
Yeah. Listen, I think there is some propaganda going on because that's what the Ukrainians want to do. They want to win the battle in the court of public opinion, no matter how it goes on the battlefield. And so you have to keep that in mind. The Ukrainians have always been good at that. But I think at the end of the day, there is some real fighting. There's some fierce heat. We've seen it. And I think the Russians, there was a set of peace talks yesterday, and they agreed to keep talking. I think the Russians will let that card play out another 12, 24 hours. If there isn't the sort of deal they can get, they're going to try a second offensive and see if their new aligned strategy works. But it is very perplexing, and there is a lot of fog of war. There's a little bit of modern-day propaganda going on as well.
Well, thank you so much, John Solomon. Again, justthenews.com. John Solomon, justthenews.com. Check it out for all the latest, greatest breaking news there.
Thank you so much, John Solomon. And, keep finding out the truth.
We will. And we love your show there, John and Lydia. Such a great show.
Thank you.
And speaking of finding out the truth, no one does it better than the NYPD, the greatest force in the world, I want to say. And on the line with us right now is the NYPD Chief of Detectives, James Essig. And Detective Chief, you did such an incredible job finding that individual, that man that brutally bashed that woman in the head in Queens. How did you guys do it so quickly?
Hey, thanks for having me. Good afternoon, everybody. And, you thanked me, but I couldn't be prouder of the New York City detectives, particularly from our transit squad, 108th Precinct Detective Squad, and our Queens North Homicide Squads, who really brought this horrible, shocking incident to a conclusion really quick. You know, anybody who watched that video of that subway was it was really sickening to watch. But, you know, so I'll just walk you through it if I can. Just
please.
What we did there. So this happens last Thursday, you know, so we have an innocent, totally innocent woman walking home from work after a hard day's work. Everybody's seen the video where she goes to down the stairs to the subway system on Queens Plaza stairwell. A male follows her. He has a cane. He's wearing dark clothing, blue jeans. He tries to grab her bag from her, and then he tries to kick her. She falls down the stairs. And then he takes out a hammer, what it appeared to be a hammer, and hits her repeatedly upon the head. A really gruesome attack. Our police officers respond really quick. She's taken to Cornell Hospital, skull fractures to the head, internal bleeding, and lacerations in really serious condition. You know, so then our investigation begins. We have to take this guy off the street as quickly as possible. So, I mean, the detectives using good old-fashioned detective skills and, you know, modern technology, video, tracking property. The victim's credit card was taken. We knew that from her bag. We were able to track the usage to a nearby store. As we go into the store, we were then able to identify the person who had those credit cards. You know, good old-fashioned interviews by the detective. We get a name, a lead. We also follow our perpetrator, the individual who committed this attack. We follow him about 7 or 8 blocks over into Astoria near the Queensbridge houses over there. It's a pantry. Again, good old-fashioned detective work. Our detectives out there showing pictures, interviewing people. We get information that he has relatives in the area. We're able to talk to those relatives. We get into the house, and we recover the victim's purse, the cane, and the hammer that was used in this incident. So now we have an ID on our perpetrator. We give it to our warrant squad, and they pick him up in Lower Manhattan at a shelter which he was residing in. So we wrap this up really pretty quick, and just a true credit to all involved, particularly the detectives who did this case.
That's two in a row. You got that guy from the Burger King on 116th Street.
That was a great result.
Yeah. You know, again, you know,
detective, I'm scared to ask you. I hope these guys are in jail.
Well, he's still in. He's charged with attempted murder, robbery first degree, and assault first degree, which are serious offenses, and he's still in.
Chief, how many priors did he have?
What does his rap sheet look like?
In New York City, from 1983 to 93, he had 4 arrests, burglary, robbery, possessions. But he was from South Carolina. He had another 4 arrests from South Carolina from 2000 to 2019. Again, burglary, robberies, kidnappings. But nothing.
So he
that
just
really
came back.
Jump off the page that would, you know, show this level of violence. You know,
he just recently came back to New York City. Then
it looks like it. He took an arrest in South Carolina in 2019. That's the last arrest we have in New York. It was 1993.
Chief Essig, there was another disturbing video: a subway attack in the Wakefield station in the Bronx. Where a woman was attacked with feces. The guy's been arrested. He had dozens upon dozens of arrests on his record. He was arraigned earlier today. Do we know, is he still behind bars? Because that's the frustrating part for so many New Yorkers. A lot of these guys have these long rap sheets. They're violent. And we just want to be safe. We want to be able to walk down the street and be able to take the subway. This lady was just sitting there minding her own business when this guy walks up to her and smashes a bag of feces on her.
Yeah, we see that more and more, people with long arrest histories, a lot with mental histories out there, and they continuously do the crimes. My detectives, we are out there, we make the arrest, we bring them before the judge, and, you know, unfortunately, in many instances, they return right to the street.
We've put our foot down here at WABC, and we are telling the politicians, New Yorkers are as mad as hell, and we're not going to take it anymore. And we got to change that bail law this November. I mean, right now, our politicians in Albany, they fear the woke culture more than they fear the common sense people.
Okay, and Detective, it's Judge Richard Weinberg. Nice to talk to you again. I want you to know I talk to my former colleagues all the time in criminal court and Supreme Court, and they are tired of it too. And they want to back up law enforcement and public safety, and they're hamstrung by this ridiculous law that came out of the state legislature. We need to change that law because the judges want to support public safety.
Because right now judges can't consider prior bad acts, correct? Yeah.
You know, it has to be you want to nail them on dangerousness. We're the only state in the entire country that a judge cannot hold someone in based on dangerousness alone.
You know, it's the perfect storm because you also have the prosecutors frustrated because they have to disclose all the discovery within 10 days. It's open file discovery, which is another problem.
Absolutely. Well, thank you
so
much.
The NYPD always gets their man. Oh, woman. Yeah.
They do a fantastic job. And Chief, we just need to keep backing them up and supporting them. They have a great new chief of police, Keyshawn Sewell. So and Mayor Adams, they can bring this city back. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Thank you for all your support. Thank you. Have a great night.
We lost, I understand, Chief Joe Esposito lost his wife, and we're very sad about that tonight.
Right. I just saw that, Chris, his wife, Chris. Oh, our prayers are with the
prayers are with him.
With the Esposito family.
Great people.
Yes. Well, you know what, Chief? We have the back. Here at ABC, John has the back of all of NYPD and all of law enforcement. So,
well,
thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Now, when we come back, we're going to have Scott Pruitt, and we're going to talk about the war on American energy.
John Katzenmatidis, 77 WABC.
This is John Katzenmatidis, 77 WABC, and we got two common sense GOPers in the studio with us. And today was the closing day of the Republican.
Today was the closing party. Day, 1 o'clock. It ended at 1 o'clock today, John.
Okay, give us Craig Eaton. You were chairman of the GOP in Brooklyn for 10 years. Give us a report. What happened?
Well, it was a great day for New York Republicans. There was a lot of energy in the room, not as much energy as we have in the studio here every night, but there was a lot of energy in the room. We had Governor Pataki spoke yesterday to a standing ovation. Rudy Giuliani was there today. And they nominated Paul Rodriguez for controller, Joe Pinion for U.S. Senate, Michael Henry for attorney general yesterday. And today was the big nominations. We nominated Allison Esposito as lieutenant governor, a former NYPD deputy inspector.
And sad that she got nominated today, and her mom passed away today. Joe Esposito's wife is
She's not related. She's not related to Joe.
I thought they were.
No. Allison is not related to Joe Esposito. No.
Huh?
No, not at all.
I read in the Post she was his daughter.
That's his daughter.
No. She's not Joe Esposito's daughter. Allison. Not
yeah, so what happened
Allison,
today with
Allison
what
grew up in Orange County. Alvin? But I tell you, she was great. She spoke very fluently and, you know, really grabbed the audience. And then we had the nominations for governor. And we heard from Lee Zeldin. We heard from Rob Astorino, Andrew Giuliani, and Harry Wilson. They all gave great speeches. But, I mean, Zeldin was on fire. And Andrew Giuliani.
I understand Zeldin won by 87%.
87%.
That's a big number.
That is a big number. I mean, all the counties came in and they said, you know, who they were supporting. Some of the counties were split around the state.
Now, the other ones are going to continue to run, or what's going to happen?
You know what? It's unclear right now. I mean, Andrew Giuliani was also on fire. I mean, that kid can speak as well. He did great. And he said that he's going to continue. He's going to, you know, go through, get petitions signed, and he's going to go through with a primary. So what happens is the way it works is if you get 25%, you don't have to get petitions. You're automatically in the primary. If you don't get 25%, you have to circulate petitions.
Well, there was four people running. Only three people got the balance of the 13%.
So none of them got the 25%. So if they want to remain, they have to go and get petitions. And it's a pretty – you have to get a certain number of petition signatures in half of the congressional districts in the state. So it's
pretty
difficult.
Tony Carbonetti, you've been a Republican all your life. Tell us what you think.
Actually, I was a Democrat for a little while. You know, us Italian-Americans become Democrats, then we get smarter.
Absolutely.
We become Republicans.
When you come off the boat.
Exactly. I think Andrew Giuliani has the playbook. And I think if you go back to 93, 94, the last time the city was being ravaged by crime, in 1993.
His father, Rudy, taught him well how
Andrew
to keep
has
our
the
city
playbook.
Safe. Yeah.
And that's what we need right now. And I think the country's moving that direction.
But Lee Zeldin is very good, too.
He's a very
smart guy.
Lee Zeldin can have the playbook. I think we need to, whoever we nominate needs to run on that platform of I'm going to take the state back in the right direction.
Judge, any comments?
My comment is the House Democrat, it seems to me this election is about running against the Democratic Party and what they've done in the city and the state.
Yeah.
Lee Zeldin may not be as dramatic as maybe some other candidates, but he is common sense. He's he's somebody I believe in and I trust, and I think he would do a fantastic job, especially against Hochul.
He's an Army veteran.
Absolutely.
He's a state senator.
He's got
a
two beautiful daughters.
Beautiful wife, beautiful daughters. I mean, he is a great candidate, too, and he did great today. I mean, Lee really did well.
Well, I understand we're getting Charlie Gasparino on from Fox News. And the stock market was down 600-700 points again.
And then oil closed
out. Oil went up to 105, 106.
So what does that mean, John, for us?
What that means? We're in deep doo-doo. I don't know what Joe Biden...
Is that a scientific term there?
I don't know what Joe Biden is going to say on tonight's
Can't talk
State
about his record.
Union.
Can't talk about his record.
But if oil stayed at 105, I think you're going to be paying... $6.50, $7 for gasoline.
So who thinks that Biden is going to blame the oil prices and the high prices on this whole Ukraine-Russia war? Who thinks that? Because I can guarantee you, it's not his war on energy, his policies. That's what he's going to do. I can guarantee you he's going to blame them.
Professor Dershowitz said it right. This is a great opportunity for Biden to turn the page.
Never going to happen.
And to move forward and to unify the country. If he plays a blame game, he's going to lose that opportunity, and he won't be able to resurrect.
No, he's going to tell Americans we have to pay for the democracy for Ukraine, and we're going to have to dig down a little deeper for the greater good, which is all BS. Do we have Garrett Gasparino on the line right now? Should we go to break then and come back?
Let's go to break, and we'll come back.
It's a common sense recap of the big stories. It's Cats at Night on 77 WABC.
Welcome back to the John Katzmatidis Cats at Night show. On the line with us right now is Charlie Gasparino. We were just watching you on TV a short time ago. You got more gray.
Tough times.
Why don't you just remind everybody I turned 60 last month?
You don't look a day over 58.
60 is the new 40. That's what I'm hearing, because I turned 60 last year.
Charlie, what the heck is going on in Wall Street? Are these just traders, or do they know what they're doing?
Well, some of it is algorithms, right? And they're selling stocks based on headlines and things of that nature. So it's not like a human trader. Some of it is traders and investors repositioning. I mean, John, this is a crazy situation. If you were to tell me that, absent inflation, right, take that out. Let's just say we didn't have an inflation problem, right, and Jerome Powell wasn't poised to raise interest rates, and we had global unrest of this type. Usually it's short-lived, right? I mean, the markets generally reflect asset values and earnings potential of companies. And, even if a significant war in Europe, if dollars to donuts, the indigestion dies down after a month because S&P earnings are slated to be, not bad in the next year. Okay, but we don't really have that. We have that on top of a rising interest rate environment, which, the Fed is saying it's going to raise rates 25 basis points, but who knows how much they're going to have to raise in the end because it's...
I don't think it's any longer 50. It's probably 25 now.
Right, maybe, but suppose you get a really bad CPI print. Okay, that's not, and then, sometimes the markets, basically push the Fed aside and say, okay, we're going to sell the bond, we're going to sell the 10-year, and therefore you get higher interest rates on the 10-year, and you get a yield curve inversion. So just remember that. That could happen.
Charlie, it's Tony Carbonetti. I saw you speaking before about cybersecurity and our banks probably getting hit a little more today from some Russian hackers. But I'd like to believe our banks, I know they spend hundreds of millions of dollars playing defense. Don't we?
Billions.
I'd imagine the Russian banks are more susceptible to our hackers than we are to theirs. I would hope.
Yeah, but, you know, are we hacking him? I mean, no one really knows. I will say this. I'm going to have a full story about this in the New York Post tomorrow, and it could be online, you know, momentarily. And I did some reporting about this on Fox Business. There's no doubt that the Russians have ramped up their attacks recently on the U.S. banks.
Expected.
Nothing has gotten through. Yeah, expected, and nothing has gotten through yet. And it's, you know, it's usually it's the same cohort of thugs that, you know, answer nominally to the Kremlin. So they know that's coming, and it is coming. It is here right now. The real question is, do we have the infrastructure to withstand it? I think the banks do because they spend so much.
Mm-hmm.
But do other industries have the wherewithal? Does, you know, does a water supply? I mean, last year, as you know, they got through and we cut off the Colonial Pipeline and JBS, the big meat distributor, the biggest meat distributor in the country. So they've had success going after our companies. There's no doubt. Not the banks just yet, but, you know, the banks are ever vigilant and you never say never, right? So that's one thing. The other thing is, are we engaging in cyber warfare with them? And, you know, banks, people at the big banks say they don't know. And they think so. They think the CIA is doing something, but they don't know. And, you know, we could theoretically, if they could shut us down, couldn't we shut their electrical grid down? I mean, that's possible. You want to go there.
I would hope we could.
I wouldn't, you could. Know. We don't know.
You gotta be careful with this stuff.
They probably have an electric grid that's
back
still
in the 1950s.
From the 1950s on,
someone's gonna talk to switch.
It really is a basket case of a country to be wagging the tail. It's like the tail wagging the dog in this sense. It really is pathetic. And the reason why they're able to exert this much power is because the Biden administration is unilaterally disarmed from drilling and natural gas exploration. I mean, we have ceded so much of the market to them that Europe needs them. And, you know, we got to need them for a little bit. And it's really frightening. Listen, I'm not a climate skeptic. I believe that there is truth to global warming. I think we have to have a transition to a carbon neutral economy. I think that's a lot of smart people believe that. You don't have to be Bill Gates to believe that. But think about it. You have to do it smart. It has to be a transition. Nuclear power has to play a role, and it's not so far. This is the dumbest way to go about carbon neutral, and it's really put the national security of the world at risk, including us.
Charlie, I was wrong. I thought he was running the price of oil up for the money. You know, I would sit here saying, yeah.
How many permits?
I was like, he's not really going to invade. He just wants $80 oil, $90 oil.
How many permits are on standby here in the U.S. that we could start drilling and stop filling Putin's coffers, his war chest?
It could be. There are a lot. You know, here's the interesting thing. If we cut them off, right, just say we cut them off from SWIFT, right, mm-hmm. totally. None of the banks can because they've allowed a few banks to transact essentially, stuff for oil. And so we don't cut them off for oil totally. But if we cut them off totally, the price of oil goes to $150 a barrel unless we drill. Now, if we don't drill, if we do drill and it goes down again, but, you know, the price of oil will go up whether they're making money or not. At this point right now, what's scary about it is at $120 or $100 a barrel of oil, we've essentially put a lot of money in their pockets.
Yeah. We're making the American people poorer.
And a lot of these European countries have to rethink their energy strategy because you think the Germans want to get 40% from him?
Well, no, but we're financing Putin's war.
Yeah. We are.
Meanwhile, Russia is a mess. And we had General Petraeus on before Charlie. And nobody really knows on the outside world what the heck is going on, except he's scared that if we put him into the corner, mm-hmm. that he has that nuclear option.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just wondering, is he that crazy or is he crazy?
I think his own generals have to take him out at that point.
Yeah, I think crazy.
They may. I mean, why? You know, Russia could be such a vibrant economy and a prosperous country. It's just, it's literally, you know, just get rid of him and the oligarchs. And, you know, American businesses would love to do business there. It's an oil rich, it's a mineral rich place. You know, the people are generally nice. The Russian people.
He's undone everything in the 90s and early 2000s.
Well,
it was undone.
The rumor was, and I think it's true, he'd rather be partners with the European community than be partners with China. I think China is telling him to go fly a kite right now.
I think the world is telling him to go fly a kite.
I'll tell you, every banking executive I know, I'm talking about CEO level, they are talking about China. They are watching everything Xi does. Does Xi tell him? Apparently, the rumor is that Xi is annoyed that, you know, he promised, like, you know, a victory in 3 days, and now his own troops are starting to. I read something in the Post not too long ago, that a couple of hours ago, that his troops are actually giving up without a fight in some cases, and it's really quite remarkable. So, listen, my guess is the guy, before he does any nuclear weapons, and, you know, I guess Petraeus would be a better source than me, but just common sense wise, he conventionally flattens. If he really wants it to win, he flattens Kiev. I mean, just does a Chechnya on him and just totally takes him. I mean, he's done that in the past, you know.
Yeah. Well, Charlie,
so that's a scary thought.
We're out of time. I want to thank you for giving all the comments to the American people and letting them know what the pulse is. And
thanks for having me on your show, John.
Always good to have you. Thank you. Judge Weinberg, thank you. And Craig Eaton, Tony Carbonetti. Chief! Don't call me Chief!
Thank you.
And my sidekick, Lydia Serrano, thank you. And let the world pray for the people in the Ukraine. And let the world pray for, well, we need prayers in New York, too. And pray for America. God bless America. Thank you.